Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hi, and welcome to Everything Is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts, Kim France.
And I'm Jen Romolini.
And we're here checking in, as we do at the beginning of every episode. Jen, how are you?
I am well. Later on the show, just to say this, later on the show, we are going to have Ray Hance, who is formerly known as Heather Donahue from the Blair Witch Project, who, fun fact, was my best friend in high school. So that's coming up later. But I'm okay. Kim, how are you doing?
I'm good. You know, I've been thinking a lot about you, and I were texting yesterday, and we were texting about two different people who we recently come to realize are either, in one case, kind of an asshole, and in the other case, totally crazy, possibly.
Yes.
And we were kind of talking about this whole, like, did I ever know this person, or were the signs there all along? And we both agreed that in both cases, the signs were there all along.
Yes, yes, and yes, I agree. And it's funny how we overlook signs when a relationship is convenient in our lives, even though, I mean, this is not about being single. This is about like friendships or colleagues or, you know, because I think you also do it in romantic relationships, but I haven't done that in a long time. But you see the red flags and you're like, oh, this relationship is convenient for me. Or, well, why, you know, why cause any kind of rift? And I know that we've both made the argument for not cutting a person out of your life. But I think it can maybe go a little too far the other way sometimes, you know, where you're just like keeping people around who make you feel unsafe or not good, or, you know, having that weird like social media relationship with somebody where you're like obsessing over them, but like you're kind of obsessing over bad things.
You know, it's so funny. There's this woman who has an online publication, and I think she's super cool, and she really wants me to write for it. And whenever she asks me to write for it, I'm always like, oh yeah, not that story, but I'll do one soon. And whenever, and she lives in my neighborhood, so I'm always like, do you want to get together? I'd like to have coffee. And I recently, and she's always like, yeah, yeah, we will. I'm kind of busy right now, but soon. And I realized, like, I don't want to write for her, and she doesn't want to have coffee with me, and it's going to be okay.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's about setting a boundary, right? The something that I am not great at. I'm not great at being upfront honest. I don't want to hurt people's feelings. I'm afraid of what their reaction will be. You could have just said, you know, I don't think that's going to work for me right now.
No, it's true. It's true. But it's hard. And it's hard when I think about like not, you know, closing the book on a friendship, you know, closing the book on a, there is no kind way to do it. There's just no kind way to do it. And sometimes it's the most merciful thing you can do for yourself. And sometimes you don't care because the person you're ending the relationship with is not worth being friends with and a bad person.
Right. And then you have to look at, like, where is this me being transactional, where I don't want to close the door on this person because I don't want to close the door on the opportunities they may bring me. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least this is something that's happened to me in my life. And not really admitting to yourself that all of the opportunities that come with this person that you don't like or don't respect or doesn't bring you joy or makes you feel unsafe, all those opportunities are going to be fraught. Yeah. And so it's like just sort of shutting the door, or at least, you know, not even shutting it, but closing it most of the way and being like, I'm not letting this in right now. And I don't know why I don't do that. You don't do that. I let these things linger and linger and linger. And I let people take up my time that I don't really want to be taking up my time. And it's something I really want to stop in my life.
Yeah, it's weird. You know, I was, I saw an article that I thought would be of interest to a former boyfriend of mine. Mm-hmm. And he's someone who I've realized since the time when we were together, which was a while ago, that was a pretty abusive relationship. And I don't want anything to do with him, but I forwarded him the fucking article. You know, like, just even keeping, like, minor little connections to people. Instead of being like, yeah, no, I don't like how that person treated me. It doesn't matter that we had good times and there was intimacy, because ultimately the headline was bad.
Right. Right, right. The headline was, you know, hurtful. And again, like something we talk about in this episode with Heather, like it was just reinforcing old stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. You know, I'm unlovable. I'm stupid. I don't deserve this. I don't deserve that. And we keep these people in our lives who just reinforce that narrative instead of like allowing themselves to let it go.
Well, I think we were both just talking about how this episode gets a little woo-woo, but in a way that I think is actually very interesting and very smart. So I'm going to be a little woo-woo and talk about manifesting.
Okay.
Because that's the solution, right? Instead of this negative self-talk, I'll never have love, I'll never get a good job that I'm worthy of, like just like that kind of, this is going to happen for me. And as a Jew, this is really hard because, like, Jew, you know, you're always supposed to be like, you know, you go pa, pa, pa and spit if somebody, you know, says you're having good luck. It's like, no, 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 you don't talk about good luck. Oh, no, 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 you'll jinx it. Like this horribly superstitious right. side of being a Jew. And that keeps you from doing what, like, the Goyim do very successfully, which is like, I am going to get that job, you know?
Right. No, I mean, but see, again, though, that is outcome oriented. I think, and I'm not in the best spot right now, but I think that it is accepting that I'm not in the best spot and being like, all right, I'm not in the best spot. So what? Instead of like attaching and being like, oh, I'm not in the best spot. Oh my God. You know, like I'm not in the best spot this week. Next week, maybe I'll be in a better spot. Maybe I won't. I think there's a little bit of accepting, because still by manifesting, you're trying to change the outcome. You're trying to control things and you're trying to force things. And this is a little different than the unlovable thing and that sort of narrative. That's like a different thing. But I do think that there is this thing about control, this false sense of control. And I feel this a lot in every part of my life, in parenting, in friendships, in my relationships, in my career, this false sense that I can control. If I just do these three things, if I just work harder, if I just, you know, say these perfect words to my child, I'm going to get a different result. And none of it is true. I can't control shit. Nothing. I can't even control the equipment for this podcast. You know what I mean?
Like, yes.
So I wonder if that's part of it, but fuck if I know. That's why we talked to Ray Hantz.
That's why we talked to Ray, and it is an episode that I almost texted you in the middle of to say this is going great because I was so happy with this episode, and it was really very sweet and touching to see the two of you see each other again, and I'm very bullish on this episode.
I am too. I had to stop from crying like multiple times. Aww. It was really intense for me to see my old friend for the first time in like 10 years. So Thank you for taking this ride with me. Let's get into the episode.
Yeah, let's do it.
Our guest today is Rae Hantz, who's formerly known as the actress and writer Heather Donahue, best known for her starring role in the 1999 international film sensation, The Blair Witch Project. After leaving Hollywood and burning all her Hollywood stuff in the desert, Rae moved to Northern California in the early 2000s, where she grew and sold medical marijuana before it was really legal, an experience she documented in her 2012 memoir, Grow Girl. Since then, Rae has moved to rural Maine, spent the last few years getting sober, healing childhood and adult traumas, and is now working on her second book on the I Ching. Sorry, guys. Welcome, Rae. Hi.
Hello.
So I just have to start out and tell listeners, I'm like almost close to tears here. This is a big deal for me. You and I were best friends in high school, and having you on talking to me with Kim when we spent our teens together reading Sassy Magazine, you were the only person I knew in Philly, in the Philly suburb where we lived, that was obsessed with Sassy as I was. And somehow this feels like a circle is being closed.
It does, in a way. It really does.
Aww. Like, it's weird, Kim, we spent our lives reading you and, like, clipping out Sassy Magazine and, like, making collages for each other. And, like, when we got the new issue, we were so excited. Do you remember this, Heather?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's why when I saw you were doing this podcast with Kim, and then Andrea was on a couple weeks ago, and then
yeah.
I haven't, like, I'm waiting for Christina Kelly to come on. Has she been on yet?
She has been on, yeah.
Oh, because she was like definitely one of my favorites too. I just loved everything she wrote.
Christina was everybody's favorite.
Totally. But equally, I was nervous to talk to you today. And the reason is that we were really, really extremely close friends in high school in that intense and sometimes toxic kind of way
Are
when you're teen girls, right?
Totally. And
even though it's been decades, I still felt some of that same anxious charge. Like, what are you going to think of me? Like, would I sound stupid? And I realized thinking about our friendship, how much I loved you. And
oh God, yeah.
And how much I feel like a little bit we let each other down. And I just wanted to get it out of the way. I wonder if you remember it that way.
Oh, God. I absolutely. I was actually telling Devin before we got started, Devin, your producer, like that we were like best friends, frenemies, competitors, just inspirers, pushers, pullers, like everything. Mm. Like we had just this level of resonance where like, that was completely activating.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I think we just activated the shit out of each other in a way that was both beautiful and creative and destructive and like all of the teen girl things in that time of just like maximum intensity.
Yes. Like I only wanted to be around you. You were the only person who lit me up like that.
Well, because we could both withstand that level of intensity because we both were thriving on, like the frequency that we operated on.
Totally. We were both really messy.
Oh God. Learning to embody that much energy is a fucking lifetime practice.
Yes.
ergo recovery, trauma. You know, like, it's been a bumpy ride to actually put all that, like be able to hold all that in my skin.
Totally. And that's, so one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you on the podcast is because in the last couple of years, you know, mostly over social media, but we've really aligned on a number of things,
yeah.
Particularly around being recovering, messy people who were super ambitious, who chased after our dreams, thinking that we knew what we wanted, even though those dreams were mostly about sort of giant ego projections.
And
you know?
External validation, totally.
Yes, external validation,
oh, 100%,
totally.
So, yeah.
How do you feel about like your first dream now, which was to be an actress? How do you feel about acting now? How do you feel about that whole time?
I feel like by the time I left that career, I was tired of being anyone but myself. I was absolutely ready to be myself.
Right.
To me, like that experience was so wild and so crazy and so unusual. Like I was immediately famous overnight, but punished for it.
What do you mean?
Well, because Blair Witch was wildly successful. The three of us actors were the ones in the field improvising it and all that stuff. And then when it became successful, for me personally, especially, I ended up absorbing most of the backlash for that. And then it was under my own name, my name at that time. And it was, so it was, it just impeded my ability to show up in the world as myself. Like it was impossible to just be who I was without this additional layer of identity kind of put on top of it. And also, there were so many security issues, and I didn't have any resources. Like, I didn't make any of the money from it, but I had a lot of the problems that come with being famous and none of the resources. So that was a really definitely challenging and terrifying period. But at the end of the day, like, I got to know what that felt like, so I could leave that, I could leave that world with no regrets. There was no like, oh, if only I'd made it or whatevs, you know? Right. I ended up having a private conversation with Harvey Weinstein by my trailer in 2000. Like, I had all those experiences. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I did not want to be a star at the end of the day. That was not ever going to be aligned with who I was. Do you know what I mean? Like, and plus, like, I think Jen, you too, like, we all, writing always was the main thing.
Right.
Like,
for sure.
Yeah. Like, and so it always came back to writing. So I wanted to be in a position where I could finance writing a book, because that was my real dream. You know, yeah. I think Jen, you and I both grew up in like blue collar families. Like, I was thinking about selling flowers at your dad's store in Southwest Philly.
Totally.
Selling like Easter lilies.
We were teenagers. Yes. Oh my God.
Totally. And like, so performing got a lot more praise and validation from my family than wanting to write a book did. That was a little more of a unknown territory. So, you know, you kind of follow the praise to some extent when you're a kid, you know?
Of course. It's so interesting what you say about how acting made you feel like you had this other layer. Because I feel like for the people who do love being actors and who do become big stars, that other layer is like their protection and their strength, mm-hmm. and everything else.
Well, and I think people don't really talk about fame trauma because you're supposed to be grateful for it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a profound loss of stability, privacy, identity, security, a lot of things that most people fundamentally take for granted. That people, so that they're, and they're, you're not really allowed to give voice to that because it sounds ungrateful, but there is a, like a real fracturing of identity that takes place with that.
So you were 24.
Mm-hmm.
You were 24, and because the Blair Witch Project used your name as the character's mm-hmm. name, so people were confused, right?
Totally.
Too.
Yeah.
Like, was that really you? Were, I mean, some people were even confused. Did you die? I mean, but that's just who.
Right.
Like, I heard your mom got yes. like sympathy cards.
Can you believe that?
That's crazy.
It's so crazy.
So what was that? So we're in 1999. Mm-hmm. You're in Los Angeles at the time. Mm-hmm. Are people coming up to you on
yes.
the street?
Yes.
Are.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's scary. There's people are coming up to you
car,
on the street.
Chased, people coming up to me on the street, people coming up to me on the street wanting their money back. Like,
oh no.
Oh yeah, no. It was not like an appreciative people coming up to me on the street because that movie was so polarizing. People did not hesitate to share their opinions of it with me I've been getting trolled on the internet for as long as there's been an internet.
Right.
So like,
right.
I finished, my brain finished forming with like trolls in it.
Well, you know, but it also speaks to something that is very unique about that movie, which is that, like, I was talking to my boyfriend about it the other day and he was like, you know, I don't know what that was they were doing. Like, I don't know if it was acting or not, but it was fucking awesome. Like, the way that movie comes off, it does feel incredibly real.
Yeah. I mean, that was the job.
Yeah.
And it felt strange and definitely made me feel very bitter and resentful for a long period of time that I was like punished for doing a good job.
Right, because people thought that it wasn't a good job because they thought you were just being yourself. So what a confusing fucking thing, right?
Right, and, right, exactly. And, like, my job in that movie was to always be filming. So that's of course, that's not, like, going to be a likable heroine.
Right.
And I agreed to that job. And it was, like, it was such a peculiar... It was such a peculiar thing to then feel that like everyone was participating in the success of it, but me.
Yeah.
And then when we were actually doing it, I had a very big job.
Right. You know? Right. And I remember you telling me, like, you were going on, like, I don't know, the Tonight Show or something. And you were so broke that, like, your car broke down on the way. Like, you didn't even have enough money to get to the Tonight Show.
Yeah, my 84 Celica broke down on La Cienega under a billboard with my face on it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And like, in retrospect, who gets to have that experience?
I'm telling you, you could not put that in a book because nobody would believe it.
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
No, but I think that, I really think that it was really brave. And I still think about this, like, you played a character with no makeup,
none,
no cool or slick wardrobe.
I wore layers, Jen. I wore layers.
You were not sexualized and right. And, like, you're creating this true and honest depiction of what a woman looks like, right? In a time when nobody's doing this.
And, like, what feminine ambition looks like.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the part that really pissed people off.
Yep.
I didn't want to fuck those guys. I wanted them to follow my instructions.
Right, right.
That's so interesting. Yep.
And now let's take a quick break for some ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
And we're back.
You said something that I related to very strongly, that your obituary was written, you were 24, that no matter what else you do with your life, none of it will ever be the first line of your obituary like Blair Witch. I mean, I feel the same way very much about Sassy and Lucky.
Right.
You know, that was it. How does that make you feel today? Like, is that something you live with? Are you at peace with it?
Oh, well, that's why I changed my name for the second half of my life.
Right.
I felt like I was in a position where everything to me felt, my life feels absolutely new. Like, I love being middle-aged. Like, I love this incredible polarity that I'm, like, in the juicy, juicy middle of, like, between the portals of birth and death.
You make it sound so good.
I'm so fucking alive with it. Like, oh man, like, I know shit and I care less about things and I'm confident in my authority. I'm confident in my body. I'm having the best sex of my life. Like, everything just feels so juicy about this time. Like, I feel like I was born to be in my 40s. And I can't wait to see what 50s are like, because I, like, just the confidence. It feels so amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, that's amazing. Because, like, I don't always feel that way. How are you achieving that? Do you feel like you're, what... Okay, just tell me the secrets.
I don't know that there's... Well, okay, I think, like, three of the things are the things that I teach in my Fuck Suffering book. And in the Fuck Suffering practice group. Like, boundaries, self-compassion, and knowing when I'm stepping on the drama triangle. Like, once I mastered those three skills, like, everything became so much easier. So much easier. I'm not a victim.
Go ahead.
To know when I'm stepping on the victim triangle. Am I in victim mode? Am I trying to rescue somebody? Or am I being a persecutor? And it's not like I don't have to engage in those behaviors, but I better damn well know when I'm doing it.
Wait, explain that again. So how am I being a person? So we're talking about something called, and I've heard you talk about this before, the drama triangle, and you've also called it the victim triangle. Explain those three things again, because I think this is really interesting. And I've heard you talk about boundaries also in a really interesting way. And we could talk about boundaries in a second, but explain these.
I love boundaries.
Yes. I need to get better at boundaries. But explain these three things again.
You've gotten much better at boundaries, Romolini.
It's true. When I first worked with Kim, God, Heather, I was just a mess. Just like a rolling around, like kind of a drunk, like just like a Tasmanian devil of just like trauma and dysfunction and no boundaries. Like, yeah. All right, sure.
Yeah, exactly. You know? But I think that's how you learn them. And like how many, you know, like I was in a bunch of like really terrible relationships. And two that were straight up abusive. And I had to look like who is standing in front of the person, who's standing in front of the narcissist, a person with no boundaries. If you set a boundary, a narcissist has no power. They only gain power by you not having boundaries, by you desiring their approval. You completely defang them when you have boundaries. And so that goes kind of into what is victim consciousness? How much am I willing to own my participation in my reality?
Right.
Right. Right. No, you said something. What was the other one? The persecutor? What is that third one?
Well, persecutor is like my most, let's say, activating version of persecutor is like weaponized victimhood. When somebody feels like, you don't understand what's happened to me, I get to treat people however I want.
Right.
Because
right.
You don't know what's happened to me. I'm entitled to behave this way because I'm such a victim.
Right. Right.
It's like, it's a big AA thing. It's like that complete cutting out of self-pity, I think, is so important.
Oh, God, it's so important. And when you look at like how that ripples out, if you look at it from a sociological perspective, like how willing are we to step into our power and be responsible for how much of that social identity we take on? Like how much, like for me in recovery, I became a gardener for a job. And if you would have told me when I was 24, 25, that I would be, you know, a 47, well, I started that job when I was like 44. Like if I would have been you would have told me I was going to be a 44-year-old recovering gardener, I would have said, like, well, how long after that will I be killing myself?
Right.
You know, and for me, that was the most incredibly healing, powerful, incredible job that just made me feel connected to absolutely everything in a way that just shifted everything.
I remember going through a very tough time at Lucky when I was there, when I was really in exceptionally bad shape. And emotionally, physically. And I thought, I want to serve lattes to people.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I want to be really good at, like, serving a fucking latte or, like, wrapping up someone's flowers. Like, that's the kind of job I think I could feel good about right now.
Yeah. And there's something so powerful about that because your connection to everything is so direct, so true, so real, so immediate that you feel very, like, for me, I feel very alive in that work. And so I still do it part-time.
Plus it's boundaries, right? Because there's also boundaries around the work, right? There's something about, and when you're talking about being a gardener, you're not talking about like being a fancy lady gardener in your backyard. You're actually talking about
I'm
being
working
a gardener for people.
Yeah, like
yes. But I'm there's amazing. Boundaries
I'm
around
like,
that work.
I'm incredible at mulching. I can spread, I can spread 8 yards of mulch in 3 hours by myself. Boom. Boom.
That's hilarious.
No, because what I think that happens with work, and especially when it's tied to ambition, and I want to get into ambition somewhat, is because, well, let me just finish this thought, is the idea of being a gardener or serving lattes or these jobs that have inherent boundaries. You go in, you do the work, you finish the work, you get paid for that amount of work, you go home, that's it. Work's done, right? Mm-hmm. This idea that like, the way that work is now, and work can be all the time, and it can fill in every nook and cranny, and ambition, and it drives us to want more, and I need this, and I need that, and the external validation. And I saw you say, write a post about Britney Spears recently, that the unfolding Britney Spears story is a great allegory about ambition. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because I know you've been thinking a lot about ambition too.
Oh God, I do think about ambition a lot because I don't feel like I'm less ambitious. I just feel like I'm more ambitious about service.
What do you mean by that?
I'm more ambitious about what I serve. Like last year I received Jukai in the Zen tradition, which is to take the Bodhisattva vows. To agree that like now your compass is to do your best to relieve all beings from suffering. And so how do you do that? Because I'm not really like I'm not particularly nice, and I don't really concern myself with that. So really discerning that difference between niceness and compassion has been a big part of how I honor those vows. Like I love that heretical vigor. You know what I mean? Like I still have that like rebellious tendency. So how do I, in all the sutras, like the Bodhisattvas all have names like according to their nature, right? So, you know, like I've seen everybody's kids born, and like those kids all come into the world with a certain way of being in the world. That just gets altered as they get conditioned and this and that. So how can I serve according to my nature, which isn't always going to look like, it's not always going to look nice, but it's also not going to look like my old version of it. It's going to have all the vigor of my old version of ambition that only cared about external validation.
Right.
But now it's for something else. So like, I don't feel self-conscious about self-promotion because it's in service. Right. I don't feel self-conscious about putting, quote unquote, putting myself out there or any of that stuff because it's in service. I'm not afraid to take risks because it's in service.
Such a smart way of thinking about things.
Yeah, it is it makes me so much more confident because I know what I'm for. I know what the rest of my life is for. I don't have any like confusion about that. How it shows up, what the next right action is, I don't know that like 10 actions down the line.
Right.
I know that my job is to open and bear witness and be uncomfortable until that next right action is revealed and being able to sit in that discomfort.
You know what I think is so fascinating though is this whole notion of like hewing to your nature, paying attention to who you are before you act, before you think, before you, you know, lash out. So smart.
Well, because it's just I'm never going to be the little, nobody's going to call me sweet. Do you know what I mean? And I am absolutely fine with that. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't expect that. And I don't pretend to be that. I don't need to be that. And I don't need to be like false humility. Like in AA, there's also like the thing of being right sized. Well, they don't call it playing small. They call it being right-sized. So you show up as the size that is right for you. You know?
Right.
I think sometimes when we are like, I'm just going to be this middle-aged lady, you know, I'm not going to walk into the supermarket lit moist pussied and fully alive, right? Oh, no, of course I am. That's how I'm going to walk in. You know, that's how I'm going to walk up to the ATM machine. That's how I'm going to walk in the supermarket. That's how I'm going to walk through this life. Because life meets you in a different way when you walk through the world that way.
So is this just the stable way that you are right now?
Oh, like, God, it is so fun.
I know, our brains are spinning right now.
No, I mean, no, I don't always feel good. What I have is a metabolism. Like, I trust my metabolism. So I don't have to, like, worry. Like, I don't worry about, like, not feeling good. Like,
okay.
Because I trust that, like, I can devour that, absorb what nourishes, and shit out the rest in a very quick period of time.
But how?
Right.
How? Well, I think part of it is meditation practice. Mm-hmm. I had a Vipassana practice for a really long time, and then I became a Zen practitioner, and that being able to return to my own skin and feel like the electromagnetic, I'm going to go a slight woo.
Go woo.
Like, the electromagnetic field of your heart is in a torus shape that extends 3 feet out from your body. So your field goes beyond your skin. Like, your skin and reality are both permeable membranes. And so my sitting practice is partly to check in with that reality every day. How permeable is my skin? How much am I able to let in and let out? Where am I able to soften? Where am I clenching? And, like, for me, romance has always been the hardest part, because, like, I'm dating again after coming out of 2 abusive relationships and coming out of a long period. Like, I had this really 8-year dark night of the soul where it was just constant failure. My book didn't sell. I started this company that I got it to the point where I would have needed a huge influx of cash. It failed. Then I produced this TV show that didn't sell. And then I was raped. And then I left California. And then I got this sum of money when they made that other Blair Witch project, because they were going to use our names and likenesses. And I fought that, which was another great thing about never wanting to be in that business again. And so I took that money and just drove around North America getting shit-faced for about 2 years and hoping I would die. Like, I did not want to be alive anymore.
Literally, like, you were not living at home. You were just traveling the country and getting fucked up.
Just traveling all over the place. I had my dog with me, so I was staying in a lot of, like, Motel 6s because they would take dogs. I was, like, staying in, like, a Motel 6 in Savannah, Georgia for, like, 6 weeks. Then I went to Miami to visit a friend who was working on a movie there, and then got a vacation rental in Wildwood, New Jersey, where I spent all my childhood summers. So then I spent 6 months there.
Wow.
Yeah, I was just...
So how did you... Wander. I mean, that sounds like a very desperate time. How did you emerge? How did you emerge from that?
By deciding I wanted to live.
Right.
By finally deciding that I wanted to live.
Did something tip that? Was there an event?
It wasn't like there was no, like, come to Jesus moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was partly moving to Maine, and partly moving to Maine made me feel held in a vast way that I had never felt before.
Wow. Just like a connection. You know, there's that quote, geography is destiny.
I could see that, yeah.
Yeah. So it was just like you felt connected to Maine.
Immediately.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, this is where I'm going to live the rest of my life. And I don't know what that's going to look like, but I know it's going to happen here.
Hmm.
Well, I also fell in love with a marine biologist who studied whale songs. Because, you know, the poetry. And and then got this perfect little cottage on a lake in Maine for like $650 a month. And so everything everything fell into place where it was like, okay, this is really where you belong. I just kept getting yes after yes after yes. And then he dumped me on Valentine's Day, and then my sobriety date was March 4th after that. So that was a 2 weeks that you could probably picture.
Yeah. Oof. Yep.
That was, I remember waking up in my car, like almost frozen to death, just shit-faced behind a crap pub.
Wow.
Yeah. So
wow.
So I had a couple of incidents like that where I was like, okay, what are you going to do? Because if you're going to die, you should probably go ahead and do it instead of, like, do it in a more direct way. Like, own up. Stop being such a fucking coward.
That's dark, Ray.
It's fun. Yeah. I mean, that's why I teach what I teach now.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it is not about the outside circumstances. It's not.
What was it like for you when you first became sober to, like, not have that reliable dulling agent, you know, just to no longer be able to numb out? Did that take a while? Did it feel immediately like it was the right thing for you? I mean, obviously it was the right thing, but...
Right, right. I was so shaking and full of dread, both like physiological shaking and psychological shaking and spiritual shaking, that like for the first 30 days, I walked around my love seat listening to Gabor Mate's In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, the audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
Like I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, I couldn't, like... I was really not very functional, so I couldn't lay down because like I felt like I was crawling out of my skin. I was just like, there was no comfort. Everything was discomfort. Every breath, every step, everything was discomfort. So all I could do was walk. Kept putting one foot in front of the other in circles around the love seat.
Wow.
For like a month.
Yeah.
And then things leveled out a little bit. But that, like remembering like the level of discomfort then, like I come back to that a lot now, of just like, okay, I know how to be uncomfortable. And that is like, that is priceless.
It really is. It's something I'm particularly atrocious at, and I've really tried to improve, but it's very hard withstanding that discomfort, which usually passes.
Oh, it always
pretty
does.
Quickly.
Well, yeah. You know, when you're having like one of those full on crying jags,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you're like just full on, if you time them, if that lasts 10 minutes, it's a long one.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And if you can keep that in mind, then you can let yourself go there and like not turn away from that experience. And like just allow yourself to let that energy move through you. And instead of lodging trauma in the body, allowing it to move so it doesn't get calcified and stuck in like your hip, and then you're wondering what's wrong with your hip or your psoas, and you're wondering like, oh, is it my lower back? No, it's probably just your psoas. You know, like
right.
You're holding all of this around your pelvis. Once we start getting into those shitty relationships with our body, then we lose our connection to Eros, and then we wonder why our sex lives, or we think it's dry pussy because with middle age, but no, it's because we've started to hate our bodies. You know, like how can we get juicy with all of life again? You know, like truly open up in that way.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've heard you say that I understand that it's a privilege to change a life. What do you mean
is
by
it?
That? Because I think you're right, but...
Oh, I don't think I ever said yeah. that.
Oh, really?
No.
Really? I think you did. I think I read it. But
no.
Maybe you don't remember it.
A privilege to change a life.
It's a privilege to change a life. I think I read an interview of yours. I swear that I did my research.
That would have to be from, if I ever said that, that would have to be from a very long time ago. Because
yes.
Now my perspective is that everybody's life is changing all the time. So buckle up, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, I think that what you're talking about, so you sort of went for it totally, right? You ran at the pain
mm-hmm.
and you allowed yourself to be sort of totally submerged by the pain. And then you sort of, you came out of it. And a lot of this was a solo journey, which we are all solo, right? Even if we're married, mm-hmm. even if we have kids, whatever. But we do create these like false senses of stability in our lives and these structures so that we feel like we're stuck. And I wonder how you think about, or when you're talking to clients, how do you think about, you know, oh, well, I have responsibilities. I could never change everything. Oh, well, I, you know, because changing yourself changes the dynamic of the life that you've made, right, for yourself and your relationships with other people and whatever the structure is of your life, changing yourself changes that. And right. People are afraid. I think that's an added layer of our fear to change, is that it will fuck up, you know, our marriages, our relationship with our children, our relationships with our parents, our siblings, et cetera, et cetera. How do you think about that?
I think that's real.
Yeah.
I think that's real. I think this is why people hesitate to set boundaries too. There are right. some people who only want your yes. And when you start to say no, you will lose those people, and that grief is real.
Right.
And nobody can take that grief away, but the grief of self-abandonment is much more long-term and much harder to live with overall.
Right. Right. No, I hear that. I hear that. I hear that.
Now, can we circle back just for a moment mm-hmm. to something you mentioned earlier, which was the importance of self-compassion? Because mm-hmm. I think that's something that so many of us struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
How do you... I mean, I feel like it's so reflexive. Like, you know, I drop something. Fuck, you're an idiot. Like the negative self-talk, whether it's something very minor or something significantly more consequential, the negative self-talk is very reflexive sometimes.
And I think that comes from, I think that's an embodiment problem.
What do you mean?
I mean, when we are not at ease in our bodies, when we're in our minds, when we're creating, I call it the identity turbine, where like when we're entangled in the mechanism of the identity turbine, where we're like reiterating these old stories about ourselves, like, oh, I'm an idiot, I'm unlovable, I'm here to be devalued. Like that was my super hot button for a really long time.
Yeah.
Please reiterate my story about how little value I have.
right.
You know, and sometimes, you know, even find like, the erotic edge of that was very powerful in getting past that for me. But when we land in our bodies, I think it's easier for us to be tender with ourselves, because you see like, oh my God, this skin, like the mind will be brutal. We will brutalize ourselves with our thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can drop out of that and into our feet and like the simple thing of doing the longer exhale than inhale, that brings the parasympathetic nervous system online, where you can and that is just such an easy way to activate that and just be like, okay, I deserve gentleness. I deserve gentleness. There's no need for me to behave this way to myself.
Right.
It's just not required.
This is an old story.
This is not actually yeah. what's happening now.
That makes so much sense.
It does. It makes so much sense.
And sometimes it's as easy as just that reminder, like I deserve gentleness and I always have. And just because right. I didn't find it when I needed it doesn't mean I don't deserve it and can't have it now from me.
Right. And not looking for it from other people, because you can't control other people. You can set the boundary, but you can't make them treat you in a certain way.
Oh, boundaries are not for controlling anyone else's behavior. This is like one of the biggest misconceptions about boundaries.
Right.
It's not for controlling anyone else's behavior. It's not for you to exercise your resentment. It is right. a statement of your skin, period. Here,
right.
we are not two, not one. We are different, but not separate. Here is my boundary.
Right. I heard you say setting boundaries allows others to see who I really am in this moment instead of who I want them to see.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my God, that's amazing. But also that's why boundaries are so scary, because yep. it's allowing yourself to be seen.
Yes. You are showing your psycho-spiritual skin. Here's the shape of me, and here's how it rubs up against the shape of you. And sometimes this is going to hurt.
Right.
Right.
Explain before, I want to make sure we get to before we go, because I know you're working on a book about this. Explain the I Ching to me. All I know about it is that Miranda July practices it whenever she gets stressed out.
Oh, she does?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's a very old Chinese book, by some estimations, 5,000 years old. There's some sense that Chinese language actually came out of it as opposed to the other way around. Mm-hmm. And it evolved at a time when China was changing from a matriarchy to a patriarchy. And so it's quite possible, and I do believe this, that the I Ching was actually around for a much longer time before that, but it was only when they switched to patriarchy that this needed to be written down. So the okay. I Ching, to me, because I've been working with it for like 25 years now, and it's, for me, this is just like a very human energetic map of all possible experiences. Like all possible skeletons for all possible experiences. When you add up all the different combinations that are possible, there's over 10,000 combinations. So you have 64 main hexagrams. Anytime I start to talk about it, it starts to sound very complicated, and it's really,
yes,
it's
I'm really lost.
It's really, really not. There's 64 hexagrams, which is, it's not like the tarot, but in some ways it is archetypical like that.
Okay.
So anyway, for me, it's just something it's a tool for when your intuition can't make it through your identity.
Okay.
When your intuition can't quite push through your preferences, your habits of mind, your ways of getting in your own way.
Right. So it disrupts the ways you've gotten in your own way. Would you say that?
It clears off the trash that you've put over your map.
Okay.
Like as if you've like thrown some wrappers or something on your map, and the I Ching will kind of clear it out. It's not the territory itself, but it is definitely a map. And it's okay. And it's incredibly clear, specific map. But it's been carried on through the Confucian era of China. So it definitely the I Ching started to internalize a lot of misogyny. Like the feminine hexagrams actually were starting to be translated as evil. So like the feminine was actually written into it as evil instead of replenishing. Like they already started to demonize anything that was not associated with productivity. Like this is something that comes up for me a lot, even when I'm working with people coaching. Like I don't come from a psychological perspective, because for me the whole field of study of psychology is steeped in normalizing things associated with productivity and pathologizing anything not associated with productivity. Like to me, if there's a period of time where you need to be in bed for a week, well, maybe it's because you need to be in bed for a week.
Right.
And the more you pathologize that, the longer that period gets, because now you're shaming yourself for needing replenishment.
Right.
So there is, I think it's really beneficial that we don't lose, that we accompany any kind of psychological perspective with a spiritual perspective. That those two things can, right now, like I think the psychological really likes to pollute the spiritual, and keeping those things in their own lanes provides a nice, clean, clear resource depending on where you're at in your process. And for me, the I Ching is actually a very nice, flows nicely with both the psychological and the spiritual. So it's a super valuable tool for me in my personal practice and for working with clients.
Interesting.
And so interesting to think of in term, you know, as it relates to psychology, you know, in that, absolutely.
Heather, what do you still want to do? I mean, not Heather. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, Heather.
Exactly. And it's not like, you know, I'm not hiding from that part. It's just more like, oh, we're doing a reset. You know, so here's what we call, here's the name of this portion.
Right. No, I get it. Ray, what do you still want to do in your life? What do you still want to do?
I want to serve more people. I want to provide that simple frame shift. Like one of my clients gave me the best compliment ever. She said, "You make really deep, dark shit fun." And I was like, oh, yeah, like that's my jam. Like, I don't really go in for a lot of the formal woo. I feel like this is a, I feel like any kind of spiritual path is a very pragmatic, very necessary, very required project for each person to take on in their own way, you know? Like, so for me, like, I love guiding people to their own essence, basically.
Okay, that settles it. I'm coming to Maine. Right? I'm coming to Maine so we can fix me.
All right. There's nothing to fix. Nothing ever. Nothing
we're
broken.
We're taking a road trip.
All right.
Awesome. Yeah.
Do you guys like to see kayak?
We'll kayak. Jen's going to be here next week. I got a car. We'll drive.
Oh, my God. Yes, that sounds so fun. That sounds perfect. I'll take you out gardening, too.
Perfect.
Oh, my God. I love talking to you. This was so great. Thank you so much for doing this with us today.
Oh, yeah, thanks, Ray. Thank you so much. This was great. And we must catch up some other time, Jen.
Oh, we are absolutely going to. This is... I'm going to take you and just suck up all the energy I need. Also, I missed you. All right.
I know.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you. See you guys.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Everything is Fine. We are your hosts. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like the show, please rate and review it on all the platforms. It really helps people find us. You can also find us on Instagram at EIF Podcast. We're on Twitter and Facebook. We also have a Patreon where we put up bonus episodes and bonus content. For our Patreon, it's patreon.com/everythingisfine. And you can find Kim on her blog, girlsofacertainage.com.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.